If you're wondering where to go to discover new music, check out In Our Headphones, the latest podcast from listener-powered KEXP.
In Our Headphones brings you recommendations and insights every week, straight from KEXP DJs.
And we're your hosts. I'm Isabel Khalili.
And I'm Janice Headley. Join us for this never-ending journey of music discovery from KEXP and the NPR Network.
Available now wherever you get your podcasts. Just search KEXP.
Playing Nirvana.
The Cobain 50.
Nirvana.
Kurt Cobain's top 50 albums.
Nirvana.
From listener-powered KEXP.
This is the Cobain 50 from listener-powered KEXP. I'm Martin Douglas.
And I'm Dusty Henry. This week, Martin Douglas, my esteemed co-host, digs into the album Cut by The Slits, which dropped in 1979.
As I mentioned when we covered PJ Harvey last week, this is Women's History Month, and the albums that we've collected for this batch are some of my favorite albums of all time.
I think you could argue every album on this list is great, but this particular run we're on right now is, you know, they're in the same conversation as The Clash, the Sex Pistols, So it's really cool to feel like they're being canonized in this way. And let's just get into it. Here's Martin Douglas on Cut by The Slits.
In a famous Sonic Youth publicity photo, Kim Gordon wore a shirt with the words, "Girls invented punk rock, not England." It's a statement that adds to the question I raised in the debut episode of this podcast. Where did punk rock actually come from? The thing is, maybe the question of who invented punk rock is less important than which early bands fully embodied its ethos. At the ground floor of the United Kingdom's punk explosion, alongside the Sex Pistols, alongside The Clash, was a group that expanded the boundaries of punk music before those boundaries were even fully built. A group of young women, a couple of them just teenagers, who crafted a style of music that didn't exist before them. And nearly a half century later, bands are still imitating that sound today. And like all of the best punk bands, this group challenged the status quo in every aspect of their presentation, right down to their name. They called themselves The Slits. Some thought the name was violent. Others said it was pornographic. Truth be told, they never set out to become feminist icons, but they became feminist icons anyway. Back in the summer of 1976, mere months after the Sex Pistols' first gig, Arianne Forster and Paloma Romero first met. The long-standing account was that the young women met at a Patti Smith show, but in 2009, Forster told The Quietus that it was actually at a concert headlined by The Clash. Legend has it that Romero, going by the stage name Palmolive, along with guitarist Kate Corus, approached Forster about starting a band together. It's worth noting that Forster was only 14 years old when she first made acquaintance with Romero, who was dating Clash frontman Joe Strummer at the time. It's also worth noting that this proposal happened after Forster was seen having a heated argument with her mother, Nora, who was a well-known promoter in their hometown of Munich, Germany. From the documentary Here to Be Heard, The Story of the Slits, here's Palmolive's account of meeting Forster for the first time.
And she was shouting and she did not care about anything. So I felt she had no inhibitions. And so I said she would be great for a front person in a band, in my band.
Chorus, Palmolive, and Forster held their first practice as the Slits very shortly after. This is around the time Forster started going by her legendary stage name, Ari Up. Not too long after the formation of the Slits came some turnover, a shuffling period that would create the group's classic lineup. Tessa Pollitt replaced Susie Gutsy on bass, and Kate Corus was asked to leave the group in favor of a guitarist named Viv Albertine. Here's Albertine on Here to Be Heard, talking about what inspired her to play music.
It absolutely, immersed in music as I was, never occurred to me to be in a band until I saw Johnny Rotten on stage. And then it was like a huge whoosh of everything, bang, 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 coming into my head at the same time.
Albertine was in a band called The Flowers of Romance, which was fronted by Sid Vicious before he joined the Sex Pistols. She was floored by an early Slits gig. When she practiced with the band, Albertine says she, quote, backcombed their hair like the New York Dolls. And that was all the Slits needed to fire their founding guitarist and replace her with Albertine. Here's Albertine talking to the BBC about joining the Slits.
I didn't like it being an all-girl group, and everyone at the time was very against being labelled, you know, because we'd been labelled all our lives. We were just these sort of useless, poor, comprehensive school-educated kids. And I said to Chrissy Hynde, who was a friend of mine, oh, Chrissy, I don't want to be in an all-girl group, it's tokenistic. And Chrissy just said to me, oh, shut up, Viv, and get on with it, they're a good band.
The 1970s fell somewhere in between the death of one notorious British Prime Minister, Winston Churchill, and the rise of another, Margaret Thatcher. Politically, the decade was a time of great transition and upheaval for the United Kingdom. There were various labor strikes, which led to the coal miner strike that instigated the infamous 1974 blackout. There were physical altercations over human rights, which, to a degree, led to the rise of punk rock. Here's Albertine again from Here to Be Heard, describing how British culture in the 1970s led to the formation of the Slits.
It was a very sexist, very male, very class-ridden society where we were invisible, really. But, you know, because no one was looking, the rapscallions scuttled in. Out of that came music.
An existing musical and social movement was flourishing during punk's inception. London has had a heavy Jamaican population dating back to when the Caribbean island country was a British colony. So reggae has always been a part of the cultural fabric in UK's capital city. Before we continue talking about the Slits, I need to tell you about another monumental name in this scene. There are few figures in the history of the global punk rock movement more influential or cooler than Don Letts. Born in London in 1956 to Jamaican parents, Letts was also on the ground floor of punk rock culture, and his longtime love of reggae music single-handedly steered punk in a new direction. Letts managed a boutique called Acme Attractions, which was not quite as famous for its clothing as it was for being the place to hear reggae and dub blasting from the jukebox. Acme was incredibly popular in the London punk scene, so Letts was asked to become the house DJ at the Roxy, the first club in the city to start regularly booking punk rock bands. Here's Tessa Pollitt talking about the impact the Roxy had on London's punk scene.
But everything started at the Roxy Club in Covent Garden that doesn't exist anymore. And all the bands, this was the first exposure for the new bands to play at.
In his DJ sets at the Roxy, Letts spun reggae alongside some of the artists that would directly inspire the first wave of punk music, the MC5, Patti Smith, and Television. That is, until Roxy patrons basically demanded that he only play reggae. Hope you like jamming too. Here's Letts speaking on the influence of reggae on the first wave of British punks.
The reason the punks like reggae was the lyrics were about shit they understood. I need a roof over my head, money in my pocket, chant down Babylon. Music that spoke about how we could live and how we could do it together.
The interesting thing about the Slits was that they weren't simply a punk rock band that got super into reggae and started playing in that style, like The Clash. The Slits only wrote a small handful of songs before they began to create a fusion of reggae and punk. Here's Viv Albertine from a BBC interview speaking on reggae's massive influence on the band and the scene as a whole.
I think what reggae really taught punk musicians was about space and letting, you know, being brave enough to let there be holes and gaps and dub even more than that, because punk was very strict, very fast, you know, get through it as fast as possible, very, very urban.
Much of this musical direction comes from Slit's frontwoman, Ari Up, the German-British teenager who was enamored with reggae music while darting around the earliest known punk shows in Great Britain. It was this connection to both punk and reggae that led Don Letts to leave his job running an offshoot of Acme called Boy London to manage the Slits. Because of his friendship with the Clash, he managed to land them as support for the Clash during the famous White Riot tour in the spring of 1977. Here's Letts speaking to the BBC about that experience.
On the White Riot tour, we had to bribe the coach driver, Norman, to allow them on the bus. Not because they did anything to him, but he just couldn't compute. You know, women weren't supposed to be like this.
After the White Riot tour, Letts parted ways with the Slits. He's only ever said that dealing with the band was a thrill. But when you hear him talking about it in interviews, he sounds pretty exasperated. A few months after the White Riot tour, the Slits played a show at a club called Vortex, where a well-known DJ was in attendance. The DJ had heard about the Slits through the Clash, the now legendary White Riot tour, and a takedown on the band in the tabloid newspaper News of the World. That DJ's name? John Peel, only one of the most influential radio personalities to ever put on a pair of headphones. Peel and his producer John Walters were particularly impressed with the Slits at their Vortex gig. Walters was later quoted as saying the band was the very essence of punk. And so they were booked. The Slits played their first of three Peel sessions in 1977. And their second just months later in the spring of 1978. Shortly before signing a record deal, Palmolive was asked to leave the Slits. There had been some long-standing chatter that Palmolive had disagreed with the infamous cover of their debut album, Cut, which we'll get to later. But the Slits drummer was actually invited to leave the band months before the album was even tracked. The firing wasn't too tragic for Palmolive. She landed on her feet pretty quickly, actually, joining another brilliant London band in 1979, The Raincoats. There's been a lot of talk over the years, decades actually, about how major record labels don't foster the creative growth of their artists, about how they are companies packaging and selling a mass-marketed product like McDonald's or Pepsi. But what's a rule without exceptions? The Slits signed to Island Records in 1979. The founder, Chris Blackwell, had an ear for challenging and revolutionary sounds. Here is Don Letts speaking on Island Records in the late 70s.
It's interesting they signed to Island Records because it's got a really interesting tradition of picking up on things that are sort of left of center. And no one else would touch that band.
Replacing Palmolive on the drums was Peter Clark, better known as Budgie, the first man to join the lineup. Drumming with a lighter touch than Palmolive, the Slits became more rhythm-oriented. Instead of the hard charging drums driving the rest of the music, Budgie's style contained a profound sense of interplay with the bass, creating a rhythm section that was better suited for the style the Slits were going for. The percussion wasn't simply punk mixed with a little reggae, but a true infusion of the two styles. Oh, And although the Slits had found such inspiration in reggae, sexism still prevailed. The group found themselves butting heads with various men in the punk and reggae scenes. Here's Viv Albertine on Here to Be Heard.
The Rastas were just sort of beginning to come up in London as well, and they were very into women being at home and not showing their hair. So just as I was beginning to branch out and feel like I really looked like myself for once in my life, these men that I really quite respected were sort of putting it all back down again.
We talked about the gender dynamics of Rastafarianism back in our episode on Bad Brains. Here she is speaking to the BBC about challenging gender-based preconceptions of the Slits.
For every image that went out about us, every word that went out about us, we fought and fought and fought for it to be right, because we were redefining how women, girls were seen in the media.
When they signed with Island, the Slits managed to get the condition of complete creative control inked into their contract. In the late 70s, full creative control on a major label was a pipe dream for most bands, let alone a band mostly composed of women. With the creative control clause in tow, the Slits were ready to record their debut full length. The first thing they did was hire respected reggae and dub producer Dennis Bovell. I might be masquerading as Captain Obvious here, but the Slits were hit with sexism every which way since their formation. By virtue of them being the first well-known majority woman punk band, they had been sexually harassed, physically attacked, and slagged off in the press by male writers who didn't stop writing about how they couldn't really play their instruments. On that last point, let's forget for a second that not being the most technically proficient musicians was the reason why many of those writers liked the Sex Pistols.
Babylon lovers are Babylon lovers.
The Slits created their own style from scratch. There was no punk band around that had their gift for using rhythm in empty space. And it's not like there were women playing reggae at the time either. So people immediately pointed to Dennis Bovell's production as the variable that made Cut such a good album, not the music itself. Even though the musical direction of the Slits on their debut album was just as much from Ari Epps' influence. Here's Viv Albertine talking about Ari's growth as a musician while recording Cut.
Very open to all Ari's suggestions. Not easy, you've got a 15-year-old girl telling the drummer what to play. Ari, out of all of us, was the most musically adept. She really came into her own in the studio. She was just firing, she was in her element. She couldn't be trapped or trained. She was too big for it all.
And here's Don Letts talking about the album.
By this time, the Slits had totally freed themselves of any of the initial punk shackles. They were this avant-garde, afro-jazz, punk motherfucking group that no one else could touch.
On Kurt Cobain's 50 Favorite Albums list, you know, the subject of this entire podcast, Kurt mistakenly listed Cut as Typical Girls, the album's lead single. It's easy to see why Kurt made this light Freudian slip, so to speak, given the fact that the Slits became a key influence on his friends in Bikini Kill, who also kickstarted the Riot Girl movement. In front of the reggae-style bounce of the music, the song is a sharp critique of stereotypical gender roles. Here's Albertine speaking to the BBC about writing the song.
Ari and I especially could write together really well, which me and Sid couldn't. He was really crippling to work with, you know, because, I don't know, he wanted to write songs about S&M and concentration camps and things, and I couldn't do it. With the girls, I could write a song like Typical Girls, and they all understood exactly what I was on about and the pressures of what's expected of you to be a young woman.
On the B-side of the Slits' debut single is an absolutely outstanding cover of Marvin Gaye's I Heard It Through the Grapevine, which was supposed to be the A-side before it was decided the prime position should go to an original song. It has been said that the mark of a truly great song is when you can play it in any style and it still bangs. And truth be told, there are few covers from any wave of punk music that hit quite as emotionally as the Slits version of this, one of the biggest smash hits of the 20th century. Musically, it's little more than the groove of the rhythm section and the guitars that feel like an itch you can't quite scratch. And Airy sings the song's lyrics as they're written on the page, meaning there's no switching around pronouns according to gender, with the kind of emotion that feels like they came from her own heart. As a full length, Cut is a breezy listen for how heavy and provocative it can be at times. And that provocation apparently can be felt by some people before they even put on the record. Although it definitely wouldn't be all that controversial in 2024, the album cover for Cut caused quite the stir upon its 1979 release. The centerpiece of the album is a photograph of Airy Up, Viv Albertine, and Tessa Pollitt, each covered in mud and wearing nothing but loincloth, scowling at the camera. Here's Albertine speaking to the BBC about the cover.
That just evolved that day. We had a female photographer, Penny Smith. We just got a bit over-relaxed towards the end of the day and started slopping mud on us and all that kind of thing. But we were very sure that we had to choose a photo where the look was right. We looked confrontational. There was no come-hither look or nothing submissive about us.
After the release of Cut, the band picked up a new drummer, Bruce Smith, and recorded Return of the Giant Slits. This follow-up album leans deeper into dub, reggae, and influences outside the rock music paradigm. Return of the Giant Slits was released without much fanfare. The band was subsequently dropped from Island Records and broke up not too long after. In the years since Cut has been released, the Slits have paved the way for, well, basically the entirety of feminist punk culture, from the woman-led post-punk bands of the 1980s like Bush Tetras. To, as I previously mentioned, the Riot Girl movement, which sprang from Olympia, Washington in the 90s with bands like Bikini Kill. And throughout the decades since, with bands such as Shopping. Here's Viv Albertine in a live interview on the Slits being rediscovered in the 21st century.
Young people started to sort of rediscover the Slits, and whereas a lot of writers, a lot of people back in the day were terrified of us, and we didn't get written about, we didn't get put into anthologies, punk anthologies or whatever, when young people discovered us again through the internet, they weren't scared. I don't know if they weren't scared because we were old and past, or the world had moved on and they could see sort of how important we were without being terrified of the fact that we were young women with attitude.
Like pretty much every pioneer in history, the Slits had a tough road to pave, and that road took many years before it led to glory. Being widely regarded as the first all-woman punk group is an honorable distinction, but the members of the Slits had to withstand a brutally misogynistic culture for it to actually mean something in the long term. Punk rock culture was made better for their contributions, and out of it came one of the genre's best albums and the influence it had on the artists who brought punk rock to the mainstream, Kurt Cobain.
My own fate, I'll follow love, follow hate.
That was my good friend and co-host Martin Douglas on Cut by the Slits. Martin, do you remember how you found this record and your first impressions on it?
It was definitely in the file sharing days. I feel as though the first song I heard was their cover of I Heard It Through the Grapevine, which I mentioned, of course, in the body of this episode, and how it was supposed to be their first single before they decided against it. And I think that the Slits cover of I Heard It Through the Grapevine is one of the great covers of all time in music, which made me want to investigate their original songs, which were really great. And because I am an obsessive music fan, while I was listening to Cut for the first few times, I was also investigating the history of the Slits. And to find out that they were on the ground floor of the UK punk scene was absolutely amazing, especially because they were kind of scrubbed out of the history books before a certain time. I mean, even years after I had discovered Cut and listened to it for days on end, I believe this album was reissued in the mid to late 2000s, and that's when the history books started to write the Slits back into the fold as far as being on the ground floor of the UK punk scene and being there at the beginning. Like, you didn't really hear that women were in punk at the very beginning of the movement.
And that's so important because I feel like, you know, I feel like the rock canon is being rewritten, and the way it was written before, maybe when we were growing up, if we read like top 100 albums, 1,000 albums of all time, like it was going to be, if it was a rock band, it was mostly going to be an all men group. Like I'm maybe overgeneralizing, but there were all these bands like the Slits and the Raincoats and, you know, that we're going to get into that were there, and they were just kind of maybe they weren't put on that same pedestal that the Clash or Sex Pistols were, but they were there, and the music is groundbreaking. It may be even arguably more so, like with how they were performing, that there's a certain, like we talked before, punk is freedom to me. And this album is just such pure freedom of expression and doing whatever you want musically without being boxed into any type of performance.
Yeah, absolutely. It was so cool to hear the Slits developing a new style in the paradigm of punk rock music. And it's weird and baffling and almost infuriating that they weren't given the credit in the beginning, let alone the years and years it took for them to get written back into the history. It's just an amazing thing to hear this style that is, even today, pretty foreign to the punk rock paradigm. And I could only imagine what it was like in 1979 when it first came out. And yeah, like when you come up with something so innovative, people are not receptive to it. Like, you almost have to be second or third in line to get the props that you have earned.
Absolutely. They're such a great band to be first in a way, because it sets up so much of the music that comes after it, the music that it would inevitably influence, it would eventually find people. You know, they were willing to like court like controversy, like for the time, the album cover of them, you know, mostly nude, was very like controversial, like, oh, think of the children type of stuff. Yeah. And the song titles, even everything, their name was maybe controversial, but there's such a good not giving a fuck spirit of this record that would be, to use the word we're trying not to use, foundational.
Yeah, yeah, tantamount to the ideals of punk. It was, like you're saying, the cover, the name, the subject matter of the songs were very provocative. I think they kind of made way for the provocative nature of punk to come, which is really cool to think about. Going back to your idea of publications and people kind of rewriting their best 500, best 1,000 songs and albums of all time, it reminds me of an omission that I can't quite shake, and that is Bob Marley's Punky Reggae Party. In this episode, I talk about how the punk and reggae scenes were basically intertwined in the early days of punk. And there is actually a version of Punky Reggae Party that included the Slits. And according to legend, when Bob Marley found out that the Slits were all women, he took their name out of the song.
Wow.
Yeah. And so I think that's an interesting correction of history in the other way. And especially when we're thinking about, you know, this is the early 80s at this point, and how there are probably so many women who are still written out of history. I mean, going back to the history of music in Seattle, we collectively only about 5 or 6 years ago found out about Bam Bam, Tina Bell, like innovating what is now called grunge and being written out of history for the better part of 3 decades. So I think that whole idea of Punky Reggae Party being rewritten to exclude the Slits not only speaks to the idea of Rastafarianism being kind of regressive in gender roles, which has been corrected thanks to a lot of the feminists that have grown up as Rastafarians, but to culture as a whole.
Yeah, and you mentioning Seattle, I was listening to this album. I was thinking a lot about Seattle and some of the bands from the past maybe 5, 10 years, like Chastity Belt, Taco Cat, Mommy Long Legs, that I feel like we're so in this spirit of being punk rock, owning femininity, being a little in your face, if that's the right term, you know, not subtle, you know, and it injects so much fun into punk rock too. Like it's, and that when I listen to the Slits, it's like seeing the origin of all of that, let alone thousands of other bands.
Yeah. Like even going back to, I feel like there is a very close through line between that mid 20 teens Seattle punk scene that you're talking about and the Olympia scene of the early 1990s, because that's how Kurt found bands like the Slits, bands like the Raincoats, who we'll talk about, Kleenex, who we'll also get into in the next few weeks, is that people in Olympia were listening to these bands, and that's how Kurt found them. And, you know, I've read so much about how the Riot Girl scene was informed by these bands. And so that is a very interesting connection between the Olympia of the 90s and the Seattle punk scene of a decade ago. And I think that both of those scenes were, I don't want to say necessarily dominated by women, but pushed forward by women. And I think that there is also an unfortunate through line between how these women pushed these scenes forward and the lack of mainstream media attention that they've gotten, because I feel as though you and I could talk all day about how bands like Chastity Belt or Childbirth or Taco Cat, Mommy Long Legs were all really slept on as far as attention outside of the Pacific Northwest. And, you know, I think that's interesting. I think it's conspicuous, but I also think it's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, as this record is maybe a testament to, like, great art will find its way eventually. I mean, at least I hope so. I was the optimist in me that, like, you know, I will sing the praises of all those bands you mentioned, like, till my dying breath, basically. So vital to me. It discourages me that people slept on the Slits when they came out, but I'm encouraged that they've had this renewed interest and their legacy is just so easily identifiable today. This piece was produced by Martin Douglas and mixed by Roddy Nickpour. Our podcast manager is Isabel Khalili, and Larry Mizell Jr. is our director of editorial. I'm Dusty Henry.
And I'm Martin Douglas. We'll see you next week on the Cobain 50 from Listener Powered KEXP, where the music matters.
And I'm Dusty Henry, and you're watching Disney Channel.